Welcome back to the SCBWI podcast. My name's Theo Baker, I'm your host, and on today's episode, I talk to the fantasy and science fiction YA novelist, F.T. Lukens. If you don't know their work, F.T. is the New York Times best-selling author of such books as Spellbound, So This Is Ever After, and In Deeper Waters. Their books deal with all sorts of fantastical and speculative elements like magic, prophecy, sorcery, and curses, all featuring inclusive casts and queer themes. F.T.'s latest book is Otherworldly, a queer romantic fantasy about bargains with chthonic goddesses, hot demons, and how to melt the deep cold of this world and others. I had a great time talking with F.T. about fantasy, science fiction, nerd culture, liminal spaces, and about the craft of writing very cool novels. I hope you enjoy. We were talking about like the habit of writing till exhaustion, and one thing you were talking about is having that kind of downtime and that sort of mind drift time that, you know, is so crucial. You know, a lot of writers back in the day would smoke cigarettes to get that. We try not to do that these days, because of lung cancer. But there is that shutting off part of the conscious brain thing and just sort of zoning. A lot of people wash the dishes and like the heat of the water. How did you find that space back into the drift, the brain drift, where creativity comes in?
I've had to find it in different ways. So when I was working, it was during those drives, I was allowed to let my brain kind of just drift and let my Google Maps tell me where I was going. But otherwise, just being able to think about different things. And then when I found my job, I switched jobs, but also pandemic happened and I didn't have that spot, that space anymore. And that ability to just, you know, think about things. It started to really get into crocheting. I had learned to crochet back in college and I had picked it back up, you know, around in 2017 or so, but had set it aside again because it's just time. But then I was like, well, I can sit here and crochet and think, or listen to a book on tape, or that's not what they're called anymore, listen to an audio book, watch a TV show or something, or I could just sit here and read the pattern and let my hands work and let my mind just kind of do its thing and think about different sparks of ideas and following them and that kind of thing. And what some people tend to forget when, you know, you're being creative or you're writing or you're plotting or whatever, is that having that time for just thinking and, you know, daydreaming, really, and having that time to daydream and to kind of follow threads before actually getting to the writing, before actually getting to the plotting, is really important. And I consider it part of the process. And I, you know, even though it may look like I'm doing nothing, and I am.
The freedom to be unproductive. And that's such a crazy thing with writers, is that it's sort of, in a lot of ways, it's like having homework every night for the rest of your life, you know, saying, all right, you got a 6-page paper due tomorrow. But there is an unproductive time. And do you find that you ever have to kind of deliberately be unproductive mid-novel? Like, where you're like, okay, well, I have to just take a couple, or do you have to keep picking at it day after day to sort of maintain that imaginative connection to the material?
When I'm mid-novel or in the actual process of drafting the book, I have to continue. I'm one of those folks that once I'm in it, I have to continue it. Or if I take too long of a break of a couple days or so and then go back to it, I have forgotten what I'm doing. Or I've lost the thread, or I've lost, you know, the steam for it. So once I am in that writing process, I am in that writing process, and I will be there until the book is done or the draft is done. So like right now I am in this kind of weird spot where Otherworldly is coming out. I have a book that I've just written that's in edits. I just finished something that I was working on this morning, and I'm plotting a new novel. And so I am actually in a space right now where I don't have edits. The book's coming out and I just finished a project. The only thing I had to do is plot. And that's that's where I am. But once I have this next thing plotted and ready to go and start writing, that's all I'll be doing. And so I'm kind of in this place where I want to kind of get it outlined and everything, but I don't really want to start it until after Otherworldly has come out, until I've gotten the edits for this next project. And then after I've gotten those done, then I will start, because I don't want to be interrupted.
You need that kind of unbroken time with it, that big time.
I do, yeah.
Well, let's talk about Otherworldly. And I'd love to, you know, we're going to jump around in time with that book, but I'd love for you just to tell me about, I know you probably wrote this book, you know, 2 years ago, and it's gone, you know, and it's whatever, like you haven't thought about it in a long time, but tell me, and you know, you've moved on, but let's talk about like how you felt about this book. And I'd love to hear about what excites you about it, or what excited you about wanting to write it.
Well, Otherworldly is a weird book, and I love that it's a weird book, and it's based on a lot of different existing stories that have been pulled into it. And I know I have the great privilege of being able to write a weird book and it being published. And it's a little different from the kind of novels under, you know, the big under Simon and Schuster, so which are In Deeper Waters, So This Is Ever After, Spellbound, and now Otherworldly. And Otherworldly is a little bit of a departure. And what excited me about it is just being able to pitch it and say, here's my weird little book. And the idea not being immediately thrown out. And the funny thing about Otherworldly, though, is that I started writing it as a high fantasy. And I got into it not very far, probably like the first chapter and a half, and had it, you know, a little plotted out and everything. I was kind of feeling out where it would go, and then stopped and was like, this is not working as a high fantasy.
So you mean like in that kind of mythical space, like high fantasy, like what, or like with, you know, horseback and swords, or
so my book, So This Is Ever After, is like a fairy tale fantasy in a castle, and there's magic and, you know, sword fighting and that kind of stuff, and that's where Otherworldly started. But then as I, you know, was teasing it out, I was like, this is more of an urban fantasy, I think, and started going that direction with it, and it worked. So I mean, a lot of things had to change. There was like one scene that stayed the same from that original chapter and a half that I wrote, and or just one kind of trope that stayed the same. So it was a significant change. But the characters of having the skeptic and having the actual paranormal, supernatural person, that kind of idea stayed. And that's what I set out to write, was I wanted to write a story where you have a character who totally doesn't believe in the supernatural, but came from a family that was highly, you know, religious and superstitious and that kind of thing. And is breaking away from that and being skeptical of what they have been taught. And then having that character who is a supernatural paranormal being kind of just fall into their lives. So, and having that dynamic play out. So that was really the starting point of the process.
And I think that's such a lovely device as well. And we're talking about between Knox and Ellery. I think it's just a great, you know, oftentimes people will have an idea and try not and think, well, like, let's talk about the idea. No, like you have this character that embodies the idea that says, here, I'm going to lead you into this other world. It's a really elevated technique. Whereas I think a lesser novelist would say, all right, I want the skeptic to, you know, to kind of overcome their skepticism and go on a quest. But I like the clash of characters between them, because it, well, so I don't want to give away too much, but, you know, there's some steam involved. And then I do want to talk about how you approach queer fantasy, LGBTQ, and how you represent that. But I want to start with like the magic of this world and what you have to do to know it well enough to start writing it, especially as it pertains to like the fantasy world, the rules, any of the world building stuff. Because it
Okay,
sounds,
yeah.
yeah. And because you said you started out thinking, all right, this is going to be in a castle with, but, and then we moved it to this kind of myth, quasi real place that's in the middle of a kind of supernatural event.
Right. And it is a quasi real place. It is so a good friend of mine, D.L. Wainwright, writes novels with a lot of folklore and has a real folklore background. And when I was retooling this and thinking about where did I want to place it, D.L. lives in the Midwestern area. They live in Ohio. And we were talking because a lot of otherworldly, a lot of the scenes take place in kind of quintessential horror scenes. So a lot of the scenes are liminal spaces and kind of have this eerie kind of pervasive eeriness behind, in those scenes. So like there's a scene that takes place in an abandoned alley. There's a scene that takes or scenes in a dark alley. There's a scene in an abandoned mall. There's scenes in cornfields. And so I was talking with DL about, kind of trying to bring in some horror kind of elements, but not, it's not a horror book at all. It's a paranormal romance. But I wanted to have that kind of, pervasive eeriness behind it. And they were like, well, cornfields are creepy. And I was like, cornfields are creepy. And they do show up in a lot of horror films. And so that's kind of where the idea of it, I knew that there was going to be a crossroads bargain, and that's why the crossroads ended up in a cornfield, and kind of how the city, and this is true to life in the Midwestern states, but also here in North Carolina, you could be in a big city and drive 20 minutes out and you're in the middle of nowhere. And that is kind of the city that they're in, is that they're in the city that is experiencing the supernatural event, and all the outlying areas are also experiencing the supernatural event. And that's where some of the world building also came in, was having the city and what are the beliefs in the city? What are the systems in the city versus what is going on in the rural areas? And then having the character that grew up in this kind of rural, area with those beliefs, and then moving into the city and how that would change, and the different kind of folklore that exists in each different place.
I'd love to talk about liminal spaces. You mentioned cornfields. And one thing that, your book does really well, and this is something that I think so many people who try to delve into genre, especially horror, struggle with, is creating a sense of that a place is inhabited by a feeling. And oftentimes that can come through with overwrought descriptions of mood. You don't do that. Like we, but you're able to get to that inhabited feeling, the world is inhabited by other forces. Tell me about like how you approach kind of letting the world know that, letting the reader know that like the world is full here and filled with
So
things.
liminal spaces, that idea has existed for a very long time. But actually during the pandemic, it became kind of like a subculture on the internet of posting pictures of abandoned places, of streets that don't have people walking on them, of like stores that are empty, that kind of thing. And that became kind of this thing on the internet. It became an aesthetic. And it's but liminal spaces, and for folks that don't know what those are spaces that they're not an endpoint. So things like a rest stop on the interstate is a liminal space, because the purpose of that is for people that are kind of passing through. And then also liminal spaces are places that serve a purpose, but at that point in time are not serving that purpose. So like an abandoned house is a liminal space. And because it should be housing somebody, and it's not, it's abandoned.
What is it housing, you know?
Right, exactly. What is it housing? So when us as humans encounter these spaces, we feel unsettled, because it's a thing that's not serving the purpose it's supposed to be serving, or it's a kind of stop on the rest of your journey. And so, we encounter those places and we automatically kind of feel creepy and weird. And I actually wrote an article a little bit about that, where I was driving on the interstate and pulled into a rest stop and it was completely abandoned. There was nobody else there. The lights were on, the music was on, and I was like, no, thank you. I'll go to the next one.
I'm out.
Because it would just hit every creepy factor for me. And so Otherworldly, the book, is littered with those kind of places in the background. And because I am not someone, my writing style is, I don't want to say conversational, but it's my writing style for fantasy and urban fantasy and science fiction is not the dense novels, you know, that you can get otherwhere, you know, other places, because I write in a more like way for folks to see to be able to picture what's happening. And so when I'm writing about a darkened alley, the reader automatically knows, oh, darkened alley. That's not good. Don't go down the dark alley. Because they've already experienced that somewhere. Mm. You know, they've watched a horror film with a dark alley, or they just inherently know not to walk down a dark alley. Or, you know, there's a scene that happens there's a couple of different scenes, but, you know, there's a scene that happens in a cornfield. It's the very first scene. And the character pulls off to the side of the road and goes and stands at a sign that says, beware of bargains made here. And everybody else would be like, I'm good. I'm going to get back in my car and drive away. But this particular character is like, oh, sweet. This is exactly what I was looking for.
Time to deal. I'm ready.
Right. I'm ready. Where's my, where are my creepy shades that I can make a bargain with? So anyway, yeah. So that's I just kind of played on things that as humans and as readers, folks have already encountered, and just kind of use that to fill out the world, because, you know, we've all seen a horror film or experienced a place for the you know, that has raised our own hackles and been like, I'm out, thanks. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, so that I just use that kind of theory.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense, because what fiction deals with is representations. You know, you have something in your head. I don't know. Maybe James Joyce could make another reader picture exactly what's in James Joyce's head. But like, a reader has the freedom to picture their own version of the thing you're representing.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And so, do you, when you're writing, I'm always interested in this when I talk to writers, because I love to know. Sometimes it's the fingers going where things are coming up, you know, and story is revealing itself to you. How does the story reveal itself to you when you're in the process of writing? Because I know there's the plot, and then but you need the extra thing to come in, you know? How does that part, you know, whatever that extra is, how does the extra come to you?
So I will admit that I am a plotter. And I plot really specific details. I have told other folks that I plot down to the dialogue, and I do it a lot, because there's definitely, when I'm writing, I am a person that, you know, if there's a piece of dialogue and I'm like, I want to make sure that this is said in this scene, because this scene has this purpose to do this towards the plot. Mm. But the other stuff around that, a lot of times I just kind of close my eyes and I think about what is happening around the character, what is the character experiencing, and I write that so that the picture in my head is translated sort of to the book. And like we just talked about, I do leave a lot of room for the readers to picture, you know, what they would, you know, in their own on their own. But yeah, that's really that's really how I do it. Sorry. No.
Well, and a word that like a lot of people use to describe your books, and I'm not sure I've never really understood the word cozy, but of people, this is so cozy. Like, I'm not sure I understand that word, but it seems to kids my daughter's age, everything's cozy and everything's aesthetic, and you know, so okay, we're I go that's the language that they're using. But I think I sort of understand what they mean by cozy, and that like you can just sit back and chill with this book, Otherworldly. What do you think about that word, cozy? I kept seeing this a lot.
Yeah, my books get tagged as cozy. I've seen that, and I think that the term means like low stakes and more of a personal story. And that's what I'm kind of, when I hear that, that's what I picture or think it means, that just that the book focuses more on the stakes of the characters in the novel and not maybe like world life changing for other people's stakes. Otherworldly does have kind of an overarching bigger plot that's going on, but a lot of the book is focused on just character development and focused on relationships and kind of the personal stakes of this overarching thing that's happening. So I think that's what people mean by cozy, and that is indicative of the four books through Simon and Schuster are more geared towards the personal and what's happening to the characters on their level rather than what's happening in the world at large.
Okay, fair enough. I just needed to bring that up because I keep seeing this. I'm still not sure, and I wouldn't say, maybe it has to do with the, you know, the characters are likable and there's a great like feeling with the characters. You want to hang out with them.
That could be too. I try to create characters that are relatable. I try to create characters that I would want to hang out with. I did worry a lot about Ellery being unlikable and being a little brusque and off-putting. and was a little worried about reader perception of them. But in the end, they have, you know, a backstory and their reasons for that. And, you know, there's got to be character growth throughout the novel, and they do grow and they do experience change. So hopefully folks will like Ellery as much as they like Knox and Charlie and Zeta, the supporting characters, and Lorelai and Bram. Nobody should like Hale. That's a character that comes up later in the book. Everybody should not like Hale.
We've been talking with author F.T. Lukens. F.T.'s new book, Otherworldly, is out now in April. So if you've enjoyed any part of this talk, you'll almost certainly enjoy this book as well. If you'd like to learn more about their work, please head over to ft-lukens.com, which has links to all their books and social medias. Okay, let's get back to part two.
Well, I want to talk about flying the characters, because this is something sort of interesting, and you know, especially with characters that are, you know, from underrepresented groups, sometimes it's hard to flaw them because you want to show a character in the best light right away. And you talked about struggling with, you know, have I made Ellery too brusque? You know, Ellery's a teenager. They have teenage feelings, and that's readily apparent right away. And we know that there's going to be some growth. And I'd love to hear how you think about, you know, flawing, especially. I think you kind of have two main characters, but I would just love to hear about flawing your characters and giving them room, how you think about that, especially at the outset of writing.
Well, yeah, like I said, there's got to be some character growth that happens. And, you know, we all love a flawed hero. I think it's disingenuous to have characters that right at the start aren't flawed, because if we want our characters to be relatable and human, or have human qualities, because we are talking about science fiction and fantasy. There has to be some flaws, you know, there. And Ellery, their main flaw is that they have wrapped up their, you know, their hurt from their childhood and growing up, and they've kind of wrapped it up into this shield of being a jerk. And, you know, that's something that teenagers do. I mean, I remember being a teenager. I'm removed from it now, but I remember being a teenager, and, you know, feelings are big at that point, and things are the worst thing ever that has happened. And looking back, it wasn't the worst thing ever that had happened, but in the moment, you know, it is. And there's always that struggle of figuring yourself out beyond your roles in your family or around the roles in your community, and that kind of thing. And that's something that teens all go through, and that we go through as adults too. I mean, it's not just a teenager thing, that, you know, even that we're growing even in our 20s, 30s, and 40s, that, you know, we're changing and learning new things. And but as a teenager, it's more immediate. It's more, like I said, the emotions are big. So yeah, so having flaws in the characters, and like I said, for Ellery, it's, you know, not knowing how to deal with the hurt that their family has caused them, and processing that, and in doing so being abrupt and being, you know, kind of a jerk, like I said. But for Knox, it's true too. He's a teenager, and impulse control is not his strong suit. But also just not putting his wants before others, because that's something that he's learning to, you know, he had always put everybody else's wants before his, and then is in a situation where he can put his wants before others, but having to realize that that's not something you can do all the time.
I really wanted to dig into Knox, because I can tell you had a ton of fun writing him, and I bet he was surprising at every, because he starts out as this other world, and I'm not giving away the show here, but he starts out as an otherworldly character indebted to Arabelle, who's we meet in the prologue. And anyways, he's sort of a bound servant, familiar, and comes from a different place. But we get to know him pretty quickly, that like there's a fully fledged person there with things to hang on to. Tell me about creating Knox and I can tell that he surprised you a lot throughout.
Well, yeah, Knox is very Faustian.
Mephistopheles, a little, yeah.
Yeah, a little Mephistopheles there.
A little meph.
Yeah, but Knox was fun because, again, you know, I started with the idea of taking these two characters and kind of pitting them against each other and writing a romance and writing a coming of age story for both of them kind of thing. And Knox was to level the playing field between an immortal being and a human. Knox had to be someone whose memory was erased every time he crosses over back to the other world. And just to keep him that same kind of level as Ellery, and not have like a power imbalance or not have the relationship seem a little weird kind of thing. He is truly an adolescent and has learned about the world through this life, through watching television. And so really the things that Knox had been watching were things, you know, TV shows that I love, things like, you know, The Magicians, or, you know, the first season of Riverdale, or Teen Wolf, you know, like those kinds of shows. So that's what he's been watching. And so he's very naive about the world and kind of knows a few things about it from past lives, but hasn't hung on to a lot of it. So it was just fun to kind of write that perspective and to write about, you know, if he's been watching these shows, what would his perception be of the things that a human would want to do? Like go to a party or go to a baseball game. They end up going to a hockey game or, you know, those kinds of things. And that was just, first off, it led a lot of structure to the plot, to where I could be like, oh, what's the next, you know, thing that Knox wants to do? So, but also it was just fun to write and to, you know, think about what, if you only watched those types of teen TV shows, what would be your things that you would perceive that a teenager would think was the best things to do?
Well, I mean, that's, it's so true to life though. I mean, about this generation of kids, like they really are seeing the world through teenager shows, you know? And, you know, I worry about kids getting out enough into the world and getting knocked around and having it not be scary and having it just be that kind of, you know, he approaches things with such a kind of naive and innocent but kind of wholesome attitude, and it was welcome to sort of think, oh, okay, like this isn't quite what I thought, but like I like his fearlessness and his willingness to kind of get out there and say, I want.
Right. And Ellery is the perfect kind of foil to him. But also I would say Ellery is pretty fearless too. And I think in Knox, the fearlessness is it's not a flaw. It's, just part of his personality. With Ellery, it's a little bit of a flaw because Ellery kind of rushes in to these situations and is like, okay, bring it on.
So I'd love to hear about how, in this book we have there's the small story, and then there's the kind of bigger world story that's happening. And I'd love to hear how, you say you do a ton of plotting, but I'd love to just kind of hear how you balance the unfolding kind of smaller story, personal story. I don't want to say smaller because what's bigger than, another person? I want to hear how you balance the more intimate aspects of the kind of story between people with the world, and as you're going through it, and how you sort of keep everything in mind.
That's a good question.
It's hard, is the answer, right?
It is hard. It takes a lot of thought and it takes a lot of forethought. And then also it takes a lot of going backwards and saying, oh, I mentioned this here, but I forgot to mention it over here. Let me go back and insert it. Or I said this on this page. I got to make sure that there's internal consistency in this world. So let me make sure that if I say this here, that this is what's happening here. The first scene of the book is where Arabelle, the witch, makes the bargain at the crossroads, and that's how Knox is able to come to our world and comes through the tree. Originally, that scene took place, I think it was in the spring, is where I originally had written for that to take place. But then after the whole book had been written and it had gone through edits, the first round of edits, I came back and I was like, I don't think it makes sense now for that, for the world building and the things that have changed and things we've added and those kinds of things. It doesn't make sense for that scene to be in the spring anymore. It made sense in the beginning, but didn't make sense after. And so I changed it. And then it takes place also in the winter, which now I think is a better, it's a better scene in the context of the world. So it is difficult to keep track of stuff like that. I use note cards for some things, but again, as I said in the beginning, once I'm in the story, I'm in it and I'm going to write it and I can't really get interrupted because I keep a lot of that stuff in my head, which is a bad practice. I don't recommend, but that's just kind of a lot of where it lives, and that's the problem of if I get interrupted, I lose that and forget things that I've set up or that kind of stuff, or forget that, oh, I've made this happen, oh, I mentioned the goddess here, but I forgot to mention it over here. While it's very important that yes, Ellery and Knox are getting along, I still have to remember to mention the overarching kind of bigger plot too in certain scenes or in this scene or bring it back just to remind the reader of things that are going on, but also to keep, like I said, internal consistency throughout.
Yeah, no, it's a tough balancing, and because you're dealing with working memory when you're trying to get this thing out that you've got. You've got all these kind of tenuous connections and that are held together with duct tape in your brain, and you're trying, not duct tape, it's like a single ply scotch tape, And so are you worried? How do you kind of quell the worries of, oh, I've got to make it work on this big level while you're in the thick of it trying to just put something compelling on the page.
Well, that's why first drafts and second drafts and third drafts exist. Is to get the, in that first draft, you're getting the bones down and the things that you feel are important to the story. And then, like I said, in the second and third and fourth drafts, you can go back in and read and be like, oh no, that does not work. Or yeah, this is great, but I forgot this and I've got to add it back in. Or, oh, I mentioned this. This is the wrong place to mention it. Let me move it. So yeah, it's really just for me, the process is, writing that first draft and throwing everything at the wall see if it sticks, and then going back through, sometimes having to, with Otherworldly, I had to rewrite the back third just because at one point in the process, the tension got lost. And so I, sent it to my editor, and my editor, and I was like, oh, I don't, there's something wrong with the end. And she came back and was like, I'm so glad you said that because there is something wrong with the end. And I was like, okay, great. How do we fix it? And then we were able to brainstorm and be able to fix it. So for me, for Otherworldly, the process was just trying to get the story I wanted the story I wanted out and on the page, and then going back myself and doing the drafts, and then recognizing there was something a little wrong with it that I couldn't really figure out. But having that editor come in and go, okay, yeah, this is, I agree, which is great that we agreed. And this is how I think we could fix it. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea, but what if we did this? And then we were able to fix it. Other stories, like the project that I have just turned in is a different, and it's different for every project, but the project I just turned in, I got edits back and it was like, this is great. These are some of the things that, to work on. And then when I turned it back in, had 15,000 more words.
Yeah, that
And
happens. That
that
happens.
just happens.
It happens. You wouldn't believe how easy that happens. You're like, okay, I made it longer.
Right? I think I added everything you want. Maybe a
It's
little too much.
got 60 more pages now. Isn't that what you wanted? Yeah, one thing I'm always so impressed with really professional writers is that. It's something I struggle with a lot, and I've written some books, but it's still something, it's still something I struggle with, which is like a fear of breaking something which almost works, right? So you write something and you're like, it's not doing quite what I want it to do, but I'm afraid to break it too, and so I can actually fix it. How do you get over that kind of fear of like breaking the back third, which it's 80% of what you wanted, but like it's missing something. Or fear, I don't know if fear is the right word, but how do you approach that kind of challenge?
I so if I it, it doesn't bother me.
Doesn't bother. You're not afraid, you're not like, oh.
So if it's gonna make the book better, then I'm all for it. If I've written something and I'm like, okay, this is okay, and I like it, but my editor, and I'm not talking just about anybody else, I'm talking about trusted people that I have relationships with and that kind of thing, come back and say, this is great, it could be better. And I'll be like, you know what? It can be better. And let's make the best book possible. I have no problems with that at all. Because I, you write and if you have all the time in the world, you could write and then let it sit for a month or 2 months or whatever, and then come back and look at it again with fresh eyes and be able to pick that stuff out. But a lot of us are on deadlines and we don't have the time for that. And it's, get, like I said, getting the bones down and fleshing it out and doing your own edits the best you can. But a lot of us are, you professional authors are constantly have the next project or the next project or the whatever, or these edits are due, or this has to happen kind of thing. And you might not just have time for that. And that's when having other sets of eyes are great. Having your agent or your editor or, a trusted friend that's a beta reader kind of thing, be able to come in and give you those fresh eyes and that fresh perspective to be like, oh, this is not working. And for me, for to have that, I love that. When folks read it, and like, oh, okay, it's great. And I'm like, well, are you sure?
Yeah.
So
You
I
can
love
tell me
it when people
why.
are like, this is not working. Oh, thank you. I didn't think it was working either, but I couldn't figure it out. And kind of thing. So
What?
yeah, I have no problem with that at all. In the beginning of my career, I did have a problem with it and maybe had a little bit of an ego and was like, no, this has to stay, kind of thing. Now I'm just like, sure, if us agreeing is the and it makes the book better, I'm cool with it. Let's move on.
Yeah. Well, and deadlines are so freeing because they pressurizes your thinking. around making something that's not perfect. If you had all the time in the world, like maybe you could make it a little better. But I think the pressure of deadlines are so important for a lot of writers because you have to push through something to completion, and there are steps to that, and there are actual things you can do to make something better, and you're working functionally, not necessarily always like waiting around for lightning to strike. There's work.
Yeah, it is work. And that's something that has been one of the things that I have struggled with people in my life is just being like, this is work. I am not just sitting around staring at a computer and, wishing for a book to be written. Being an author is work, and it is more than just writing a book. It's keeping up with social media, it's answering emails, it's doing podcasts, it's doing all these different things. So there's this perception that authors just kind of sit around and wait for lightning to strike and then write a book. And that's not really true at all. It is a job. And that's why I said I worked two jobs for 8 years. And it's something that I've had to really struggle and impart to just people in my life that like, no, I'm working. I know it doesn't look like it, maybe to outside, but I am actually trying to get something done.
I wanted to ask you about, because you're kind of tiptoeing around the Faustian bargain, and your book starts with that Faustian bargain, and
Yes.
there's a lot of stuff. Tell me about what drew you to that.
It's funny. When we were talking about my journey to become an author, I said I went back and got another degree in English literature, and one of the classes I took was a Shakespearean class, and the professor, Dr. Sawyer, was super into Marlowe. That was the first thing we read was Marlowe's Faust. And we were assigned a paper about whatever we wanted really to write. And I wrote about kind of new media depictions of Marlowe's Faust. And so I had done a ton of research about that and was kind of thinking when I wanted to, was thinking about writing this book. Dr. Sawyer was really big into and had written papers and books about how Disney had appropriated a lot of Shakespeare. And so I was thinking to myself, what would like a book be that Dr. Sawyer would read and be like, oh, this is Faust. So that's kind of a really silly reason, but it's kind of one of many, reasons and ideas that were kind of percolating in my brain about, maybe Dr. Sawyer would read this and be like, oh my gosh, this is Marlowe, this is Faust. So there was that. But there was also the fact that I really just had that knowledge and, knew that I was writing this kind of weird paranormal thing and thought about what would be a great way to have this character come from another place and be paranormal and all that. And that's where that came up with. And used the Crossroads Bargain. And Crossroads Bargain, I actually wrote about this too, an article about it, that it's so pervasive in media, but you might not recognize it. But there's been like Looney Tunes episodes about it. There's one where Yosemite Sam makes a bargain. And it's really popular. There's a video game called Cuphead that is Faustian bargain. So it's all around us.
Yeah,
That
I
trope
mean,
is.
we all make one, right? Like in some level, and we all think that payment will not come due. Well, it's coming. They're coming. All right. What could you tell, I don't want to say little KT, but little FT, but like yourself working, grinding away at night, starting on working on the first book, what would you tell that person who's trying to put it together now that you've gotten a bunch of books published, New York Times bestsellers, doing awesome? What would you tell that person about anything?
I would tell that person two things, and this is advice that I would give to writers. Keep pushing. The stories that you want to put out in the world are important, and we want to, read them and to you know, keep trying, and hopefully, you know, things will happen for you. But also, I want to tell writers and 8 years ago, FT, 9 years ago, FT, to be patient. That the first thing that comes along may not always be the best thing, and to do your research, but be patient is a big one, because I know that so many writers are striving really hard to make a career, to get a book out, to be a bestseller, to, you know, do all these things, and, you know, might jump at a chance that's not the greatest chance. And then also, you know, just keep working.
Don't take that bargain when
exactly.
A mysterious stranger shows up at a crossroads and says, here's this book deal that you not may not be great for you.
You're right. Beware of bargains made here.
Yes.
That's all the time we have today on our program. On behalf of all of us at SCBWI, I'd like to thank FT for making the time to talk with us. If you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe to our totally free show and leave some stars. Please head over to scbwi.org if you want to learn more about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. This episode was produced by Chelsea Kimiko Hall and edited by Samantha Thomas. This podcast is made possible with support from the Authors Coalition of America. Thanks for listening this week, and we'll see you again next week. So long.